clerk will call the docket.
Wilson versus
You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. My name is Robert E. Scully, Jr. I represent the appellant, James Wilson. I'd request reserve 3 minutes of time, if I could, for rebuttal. Mr. Wilson contends on appeal that the trial court made three errors in dismissing his complaint, his first amended complaint, in the trial court. First, the court struck the fraud count, concluding that as a matter of law, Mr. Wilson could not reasonably rely upon the false promise of intent to perform the holding of the property that was conveyed in trust. A second, that there was no factual basis asserted in the complaint upon which a fiduciary duty could be premised against Defendant Lee. And third, that the rescission claim did not state a claim because no undue influence was actually alleged. The first issue, I think, is clearly preserved. I don't think there's any question. There is a question as to whether the other two issues were adequately preserved in the trial court. I'd like to address the first issue first, because I don't think it's in controversy. And that is whether the claim stated a claim for fraud, whether the amended complaint stated a claim for promissory fraud. And I think you need go no further than paragraph 46 of the amended complaint, in which it is alleged that Tate and Lee actually went to see their own lawyer. And unusual in a fraud case, the lawyer's notes are actually appended to the complaint. And what they told their lawyer, Mr. Briel, as reflected in the notes attached as Exhibit 5, is that they intended to purchase Mr. Wilson's property, which Mr. Lee had listed for sale, for approximately $6 million.
But the holding of the trial court was not that promissory fraud wasn't alleged, but rather that reasonable reliance was not demonstrated by sufficient pleadings.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What's wrong with the trial court's analysis?
The problem with the trial court's analysis is that the trial court relied entirely on Murayama and Metrocall, which have nothing to do with this case. Murayama and Metrocall both found that there is no reasonable reliance as a matter of law based on the old heuristic that we all heard of when we were young, which is fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. Those cases were both cases in which parties settled existing claims which were based on fraud or misrepresentation and then sought to challenge the settlement agreements on the grounds that they were fraudulently induced. And this court said, no, as a matter of law, once you've alleged that somebody is dishonest, you can't reasonably rely upon their representations. That has no basis and no place in the law of promissory fraud, much as caveat emptor has no place in the law of promissory fraud. There is no way upon which one can investigate the mental intent of someone who has committed a promissory fraud. That is, someone who has told you, I intend to perform this promise, but I have no present intention of doing so.
How do you respond to the right for the wrong or different reason theory of the appellees that, you know, the whole plan was to effectuate, it is alleged, a system where the trust would be used to funnel money back to the plaintiff in an effort to permit the defrauding of creditors. And they argue that those allegations are not in their response of pleadings or in some discovery, but actually in the complaint itself.
Well, I think the plaintiff's former counsel, I didn't draft the complaint, but I think the plaintiff's former counsel was candid with the tribunal in admitting that part of the con that was performed on Mr. Wilson, an 83-year-old, seriously ill man who had trouble reading, was that, this would somehow...
The argument is what he's asking and what you're asking us to do, and what he is asked the trial court to do, is to permit the original plan, which, while it may or may not have originated with him, he wanted to take advantage of it, which essentially, and tell me if I'm inaccurately summarizing it, allows a bunch of short sale discussions to go on as if the price of the property is different from the actual transactional value that's exchanged, which could be argued to be an effort to defraud creditors. So if that's in the complaint, and if that is not contested in the complaint, why isn't that the itself a dispositive point? It cuts through reasonable reliance, cuts through promissory fraud, cuts through fiduciary duty breach, cuts through everything, actually.
Well, I would agree with you. An in pari delicto defense would cut through all of those claims. The reason I don't think it exists is the guts of my reply brief. Waller versus Eanes, as much as it's distasteful for me to cite it to this court because I consider it a sort of vestige of the Jim Crow era in this court, but Waller versus Eanes is still good law. And Pomeroy equity jurisprudence, which it cites, is still good law, and which this court said, and at least five other jurisdictions have said, there is no moral equivalency between an actual promissory fraud defendant who cons somebody into believing that he is, in fact, that it's possible to transfer a property into trust and somehow therefore hinder his creditors. There is no moral equivalency, and therefore there is no in pari delicto. But that is a key issue in this case. There's no question that Mr. Wilson was misled into believing that you can use creditor protection trusts to hinder your creditors. Not completely defraud them. There's no allegation that he intended to defraud his creditors.
Well,
merely to delay them until he could resell the property and pay them off. He didn't get releases. The short sale releases were only against the liens to the property.
So the principle of law you're advocating is if you have a fraud feasor, alleged fraud feasor, suing another alleged fraud feasor, the principle of estoppel is inapplicable if the defendant fraud feasor came up with the idea and sold the idea to the plaintiff fraud feasor.
Precisely. That's exactly what makes this different from Body versus Stocks. In Body, this court said...
Why should the court make that distinction?
Because
why does it matter who came up with the fraudulent idea if it was being owned and executed and embraced by one of the litigants, and then the litigant comes to the court asking for our effectuation of it?
Well, I think it's too far to say that he owned it, embraced it, and effectuated it. He was duped into believing in it. He didn't understand it. This is a man with an eighth grade education, 83 years old, in bad health, two heart attacks, dyspnea, can't read without assistance, a clearly impaired guy who is told by his own real estate agent, Mr. Lee, or at least the person he believed was his real estate agent, as we'll get to later, that this was a permissible thing, exactly like what happened to Mr. Waller in Waller versus Eaves. He was taken advantage of by people he trusted in an obvious short sale creditor protection trust con. And they're out there. With all due respect, Your Honor, all you got to do is go on the internet and you will find lawyers selling creditor protection trust cons. Fortunately, not so much in Virginia, but in some of the larger commercial states like California and New York, you will find them. And for this court to adopt as a blanket rule that because there may have been a element of the con that involved the hindering of third-party creditors, not defrauding them, they still have claims. There are fiery fascists outstanding against this claim. If Mr. Wilson were to recover damages, in this case, there are judgment liens that attach to his recovery. His creditors are not going to be defrauded. That's one of the reasons this case needs to succeed, is so that his creditors can be paid as they should have been paid if he had not been defrauded. And that's there is no moral equivalency. That's the only way I can put it. I don't think you can look at the defendant's conduct and the plaintiff's conduct on the same moral plane, and for that reason, in pari delicto doesn't apply. And I've cited the cases from other jurisdictions in which the courts, but in California, Missouri, New York, have all held to that effect. So I think that issue really ought to go back to the trial court as well, but not as a matter of law, but for trial to a jury. As you yourself said, Your Honor, in an article I love to read over and over about where we make these decisions about what's morally reprehensible and what's reasonable as a matter of law, those decisions are made in Virginia by juries. Those 12 men that are brought into the courtroom, as Mr. Chesterton said in his 12 Men, you know, the juries are better than judges because they haven't gotten so used to this. You and I are used to frauds. We're used to bad conduct. We're used to all these things. We see them all the time, and we get inured to them. And that's why we can say, well, you were guilty. You had some unclean hands. But there's no comparison in this case between what these defendants did to this man and the fact that he allowed himself to believe what all of us now in the calm light of the afterthought recognize was too good to be true. And that's why I request that you not dismiss the complaint or on the right for the wrong reason basis. I don't think there's any question that this is not the station's number two case where there was an allegation of, you know, either breach or fraud. This is a promissory fraud case. It's alleged to be promissory fraud. MetroCall doesn't bar it, and for that reason, I think the fraud claim should be remanded to the trial court for trial. The second case, or the second claim, was a breach of fiduciary duty claim against Lee. Now, this one is admittedly a tougher case. I think that the legal issue was preserved by the exceptions that were recited in the trial order. That is, the legal theory as to why there was an agency relationship is clearly in the exceptions I put on the final order. It was also raised in the motion for reconsideration, and the trial court actually ruled on the motion for reconsideration, albeit out of time. But it still shows that Judge DiMatteo would not have made any different decision if she'd entered that order during the 21 days after her final order. And that's the issue on appeal. Would it have made a difference if the trial court had had an opportunity? And it did have the opportunity. It simply said, I wouldn't change my mind until, you know, February 23rd. And I think that indicates that the requirements of both Rule 525 and, more importantly, 801-384 have been met.
But did you plead that the subagent was appointed by the main agent?
That's the problem.
Yeah, but did you?
No.
Well,
there is no allegation of appointment. But I think, given the facts that are alleged, it is alleged that he was the agent. It is alleged that he obtained the listing agreement for his corporate principal. It is admitted that he was the one who was attempting to promote the sale between the February listing agreement and the July time when they stopped talking about a sale to a third party and started talking about a sale to themselves. And I think you can infer from the sole dealing, from my client's reasonable understanding, that you can infer appointment. I agree with you. Appointment is not expressly alleged, but I think it can be reasonably inferred from the facts that are in the complaint, and based on that reasonable inference, I think there is a legal basis for the fiduciary duty, as I said, based upon the fact that there is no contract, and therefore the common law of agency supplies the duty of subagency. It would have been clearer if the complaint had said subagent rather than agent, but I don't think that destroys the claim, and that claim ought to go back for trial as well. And then finally, the claim for undue influence. Admittedly, that also was not pled as a separate count as you would expect to see. Generally, if you want to plead undue influence, you put a count that says undue influence. This one simply said fraud and all the facts that give rise to the presumption of undue influence, and then sought rescission. And I think we don't look at formalities. This is, you know, we're not a field code pleading state. We look at the substance of the facts in the complaint. And the facts in the complaint allege all of the elements that give rise to a presumption of undue influence.
Right? But forget caption. I mean, the words undue influence aren't even in there. So if I'm the lawyer, I get this and I'm, you know, I'm served with this, or whatever, it's hard to, I mean, really tease together that there's this count there.
I understand that, but if you put the facts together with the claim of rescission, which is, you know, consummate unjust enrichment, undue influence. I mean, undue influence is both a legal claim and an equitable claim.
So the other side should have filed a bill of particulars or something to say, hey, what exactly are you pleading?
Well, but particulars request facts. The facts are all there. The problem is that the buzzword, this is undue influence, and that's why rescission should exist, isn't there. And that poses the question under Virginia law as to how much do you have to have fair notice. My position here is that this gives All of the elements are there, even though the buzzword isn't. And you don't have to be any cleverer than I am, and I'm not all that clever, to read this complaint.
Would you like to save the remaining amount of your time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, and I represent the buyer of this transaction, KKR2 Limited Liability Company. I'm accompanied today in the courtroom by Billy Bang, who represents Ed Lee, by Frank Bredemus, who represents Mark Tate. And I'll ask you to permit me to stretch the rules just a little bit to mention that my colleague, Julie Porto, is the one with the crutches in the first row. Otherwise, she would be up here as well. What I propose to do is to discuss briefly the procedural issues in the case, the substantive issues in the case, and then yield the lectern to Mr. Bang because he has some issues to discuss with Mr. Lee, who has separate arguments. The procedural issues are laid out fairly well in the briefs, and I don't propose to replow all of those here. What I do propose to do is mention one issue that I think Mr. Scully has laid out that would be an interesting thought for us to consider today, which is, can a party preserve an issue for appeal merely by appending that a new objection on the final order for endorsement without asking the court to actually rule on it? Mr. Scully cites Code Section 8.01.384 for the proposition that that's possible. But this is not the first time someone has tried to do that, and you have always rebuked someone for doing so. The most famous instance is Nussbaum versus Berlin. Nussbaum was the one where, as you will recall well, Nussbaum attempted to preserve an issue in two different ways. One was by going to a hearing and handing up something in writing saying, here are my objections, including a brand new due process argument. Unfortunately, he appended the now famous phrase, I'm not asking you to change your ruling. And this court understandably ruled that that wasn't sufficient to do it. The other way in which Nussbaum claimed that he had preserved it was by putting it in the final objection, in the final order. And at the bottom of page 440 of your opinion, in language that we quote on page 6 of our brief, this court said that's not good enough either if you don't ask the court to rule on it. That's what happened in this case today.
What arguments precisely were within that last epilogue of the case that had not previously been asserted in some brief or oral argument?
Well, let me mention the first thing that comes to mind, which is the impera delicto argument that he's raised now here. Actually, that was raised for the first time in the reply brief in this court. So it's twice not preserved, one of Rule 525 downstairs, and second because of the Palmer versus Atlantic Coast Pipeline decision that you issued last year here.
But did the trial court rule on that question?
So
if it comes up by the appellee as a right result, wrong reason, why would the appellant have to advance a peremptory strike in the appellant's brief?
Because the appellant must do so in the context of Rule 525. You can't ask for a reversal based upon something that you didn't ask the trial court to decide. The trial court never decided any of these things. The trial court was asked to decide these things on various bases, but all of the preservation language that he has, all conformance with Rule 517C and Rule 527, the clear and exact reference he has is to the exceptions, or the objections in the final endorsement, and to his motion for reconsideration. There isn't any other place that he's ever asserted that he's preserved these issues. And that I understand the reason for the clear and exact reference requirement. It's for your protection and for mine, in order so that we don't have to go combing through the record to find out if some of these new arguments were preserved elsewhere or preserved at all.
But assuming we can do that, what about the arguments that he made in the brief in opposition to the demurrer?
I've looked through those and have found, for example, I've looked through that to find out if there was a raising of the impera delicto issue, and there wasn't any mention of it. There's never been a mention of that before. If he has done so and raised them in the brief in opposition to the demurrer, and that's where he claimed that he preserved the issue, then he had an obligation in his brief, under your rules, to place them before us, to place them before you. I'm fond of telling lawyers that the rules are not gentle suggestions, they're the requirements. And Mr. Scully has clearly not met his requirement of telling you and telling me this is where this issue was presented. He's made a vague reference to saying it's in the objections.
With the exception of the fraud-feasor can't sue a fraud-feasor principle, what is it about actual reliance, the reasonable reliance, actual fraud, promissory fraud, fiduciary duty, why isn't that covered by their brief opposing the demurrer? And once it's raised and the trial court rules on it, you don't really need to do anything at that point.
First, I will say that I agree that if the court has indeed ruled expressly on an issue, then you don't need to reassert it in the objections or anywhere else.
So promissory fraud is before us. Reasonable reliance decision by the trial court is before us. Fiduciary duty breach is before us. Is that right?
Conceivably, but I don't think that that's the case. And I don't think that he's complied with the rule to let us know where he's preserved it. I mean, if there's no actual requirement that he let us know where he's preserved it, then Rule 517C is empty, dead language.
So to understand what you're saying that because he didn't identify the prior demur briefs as part of his reference, well, ordinarily, if that were the problem, a show cause would be issued, he'd be allowed to amend his petition or amend his reference and point us to the obvious place where the arguments were made.
That's what I understand in the Rule 51A.
Can you address the fraud feasor, can't sue, or fraud feasor point, and whether you raise it as an appellee, the appellees do, as a right result, different, or wrong reason? What traction, if any, does it have on appeal?
I want to make sure that I understand you. Which issue was it one that you asked about?
The fraud feasor can't sue a fraud feasor bar.
Oh, I understand that. His answer to that is by citing the cases on in peri delicto, saying that there's no equivalency between a really bad tort fraud feasor and a really lower one. That's something that is coming up now for the first time in the rebuttal and in the reply brief. I haven't had an opportunity to brief it at any point in this case.
The trial those cases were primarily cases where the victim fraud feasor, so to speak, was the subject of undue influence or some sort of oppressive conduct as opposed to mere fraud.
Right. I think that's probably right. In this situation, what you had was two parties under their allegations who were equally trying to conspire, that's what he called it in the count three, to defraud creditors, to hinder creditors at the very least. And he's asking that the court sanction that and indeed let him out from the benefit of that. We cited the old case law in which this court has long ago said we're never going to help somebody in that position. Now, you've asked what traction it has at this stage. I think it's the fundamental basis one of the fundamental bases for the court's rulings. The other one that the trial court expressly said is on page 428 when she wrote in her letter opinion, every document attached to the complaint at every turn in this alleged sordid affair with blinking warning lights of claim. That was the real basis for why the trial court ruled the way it did.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting. Are you saying the trial court ruled on the fraud feasor bar?
I don't think that the trial court did rule on the lesser degree of fraud bar because I don't think that it was ever presented. It was never argued in the lower court, so I don't think they can raise it for the first time here. Let me mention a couple of other things having to do with the substantive issue. I should mention that in assignments 1 and 2, you probably will have noted that they begin with an allegation relating to the claims of fraud and constructive fraud. As we mentioned in our brief, the claim of constructive fraud was abandoned when the plaintiff amended and filed an amended complaint. So since they have not realleged or incorporated by reference the original complaint, those are no longer before the court. So there's not really a remaining claim of constructive fraud. With regard to rescission, I think I've touched on this. I want to reemphasize that their claim is one that this court has never approved, which is claim for equitable relief without even an assertion, much less proof, that there's no adequate remedy at law. I recognize the old case law that we learned back in law school that land is unique, and yet they didn't assert that below. They don't assert it in this court. There's never been a pleading that says that the plaintiff has no adequate remedy at law and so therefore equitable relief is appropriate. You've never permitted that in this case. Since you have said time and time again that pleadings are as essential as proof, the fact that they never alleged the fundamental basis for equitable jurisdiction, the lack of an adequate remedy of law, means you cannot reverse on this basis. If you have more questions, I propose to turn the lectern over to Mr. Bank, who can address the issues for Mr. Lee.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is William Bang. I'm counsel for Edward Lee. I propose to address assignments of error 3 and 4, which are specific to Mr. Lee and regard the alleged breach of fiduciary duty, the basis of which is alleged to have been formed by a sub-agency relationship. As previously stated by my colleague, this sub-agency relationship was raised for the first time as part of objections. This was not before the court as part of the demur or the objection to demur, and I do not believe these issues were preserved as a result of that. In Mr. Scully's argument, he did admit that there was no allegation of appointment of a subagent. However, he suggests that there is an implication of subagency based on the facts related in this case. I would state to the court that this is insufficient to establish a subagency relationship in this case. In addition to the allegations, it's alleged that Mr. Lee and Mr. Wilson have a long-time friendship, that they have a personal relationship stretching back many years. The mere incidence of Mr. Lee being present and being around Mr. Wilson while he's interacting in this case is not suggestive of a sub-agency relationship. In addition to that, it's suggested in the pleading that Mr. Lee was negotiating with Mr. Wilson's creditors. However, it's also alleged that Mr. Tate, who's unrelated to Paladin Real Estate, who's not alleged to have any sort of sub-agency relationship, was also granted the same ability to negotiate with his creditors. For that reason, I would state to the court there is no basis for assuming that there has been a sub-agency relationship created, certainly not expressly, or even to be inferred based on the facts presented to the court in the brief.
Was there ever a time where the plaintiff asked for an opportunity to amend so that the sub-agency theory could be amplified?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, there has not been. As I stated previously, the sub-agency argument was raised for the first time following the court sustaining the demur and was simply raised an objection.
So the motion to reconsider didn't say, well, I thought I did enough allegations on this, but if I didn't, sorry, give me an amendment and I'll do it next time.
There was an argument for that in the motion to reconsider, but as has previously stated in the brief, this motion was not ruled on by the court within the 21-day period.
And so, am I right, there's no assignment of error that the trial court erred in failing to permit an amended complaint?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Am I right that there is no assignment of error alleging that the trial court erred in not permitting an amended complaint to amplify the sub-agency theory?
That is correct, Your Honor. The assignments of error are simply that the court failed to recognize a sub-agency relationship as part of the original pleading. And as also stated in my brief, and I don't want to belabor this point with the court, the sub-agency relationship alleged would allow for a recovery under contract from the agent, as stated in the Augusta case. However, there is no present, to my understanding, ability to recover against the sub-agent in a theory of tort, as is what's being sought by the plaintiff. For that reason, I believe assignments of error 3 and 4 should not be the basis for a new trial. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. Thank you very much.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding 801-384 and the statute, I think the Nussbaum case is a fascinating case, and it's fascinating precisely because the late Mr. James Roberts, who is well known to all the members of this court, was a courtly Virginia gentleman who embodied the courtesy the court spoke of. I like to think of myself as courteous, but I certainly am not as genteel as he was in Nussbaum. The reason that the court said in Nussbaum that his preservation of error on the objections to the order was because he told the court he specifically told the court he wasn't requesting a reversal of the rulings. That's what Nussbaum stands for. That's a waiver issue. The statute says, and this court said in Helms versus Massbile, you got to follow the statute if there's an inconsistency between the statute and Rule 525. And Lee versus Lee.
Your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Call the next case.